The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the March 18th, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour, which is also the 152nd edition. I have a mixed bag of a show for you tonight. If I can keep my attention focused, I think it will be interesting. I'll be covering such diverse topics as the importance of donating, but it's not what you think, and to the latest nonsense from Jews as to their rights and demands, to the continuing saga of Charles Kraft, which is good that it's continuing. We want it to continue to work its way into the intellectual elite. I'm saying that kind of tongue-in-cheek. When you read the comments to anything that has been written about him, you wonder about this intellectual elite. But these are supposedly people who were reaching people who are interested in the arts. And then I'm going to move on to which translation of Mein Kampf should you be reading. So there's a lot of interesting things to say about all of this. I have it well organized, and if I can go along according to my script here, I think it will work out very well. You're welcome to call in during the second hour and voice your views on these topics. The call-in number is 1-830-443-4911. I'll remind you of that in the second hour. I didn't send out my mailer for today's show, so I don't have very many listeners right now, but I hope it will grow as people check in to see what I'm saying. The first thing I want to make is some important announcements, you know, a few things before I get started. First, I have disabled, or my administrator has disabled, Carolyn@CarolynYeager.com email address. As someone has been sending me mail using that address, and we're trying to find out how they're doing that. So anyone, and I've always said that I've switched over to CarolynYeager.net, and people should use that, although there are still probably people who are sending things to CarolynYeager.com, it has been getting to me, but it won't anymore. So if you're using that, if you haven't paid attention to what you're using, and you're still thinking of me and my site as CarolynYeager.com, you should change that, because if you send mail to CarolynYeager.com now, it'll be returned to you. You'll find that out real quick. And if you have links on a website that you own, please check that, because if it still is linked to CarolynYeager.com, it has been working, but it may not continue to work. I'm not sure about that, but it would really be a good idea to change that to CarolynYeager.net. Please, those of you who might have that, please check what you've got and change it to CarolynYeager.net. And I thank you very much for that, and I thank you for linking to my site on your sites, and thank you for linking to the White Network. We could use some more of that. So speaking, though, of CarolynYeager.net, I want to draw attention to two very special historical records that are still on the first page of my site that relate to the Austrian annexation to Germany, of which the 75th anniversary was just commemorated and was the subject of this Heretics Hour program last week. I'm very interested in Austria, but more so when it was the Ostmark, part of the German Reich, which for many reasons, but not least because of my friendship with Wilhelm Christmann, and now because of Wilhelm Christmann, a new friendship that I have with Wilhelm Wenger, who is also a keeper and preservationist of the history of true Austria, and who also lived through the great days of the 1930s and 40s as a young person, six or seven or so years younger than Willy Christmann. Willy Wenger's brother was 2 years younger than Willy Christmann, and he was about 4 years younger than his brother. So that's the way that works out. And Willy's brother, Leopold, who who was, like I said, 4 or 5 years older than him. Four, I think. I'm not exactly sure. Didn't survive his active participation in the war, as did Willie Chrisman. But luckily, Willie Wenger did. And I say luckily because he very well could not have, as he also was involved in the last days of the war as the Hitler Jugend turned soldier at the tender age of 18. He was one of the few among his unit that did survive. And it's a great story that he has told and written and even amusing in parts, even though it's full of horrible things. Well, I mean, he doesn't make it seem so horrible, but, you know, it was an extraordinarily traumatic time. And, he's, written this, his ordeal or, odyssey as a Fahnenjunker, in the literal last months of the war. And, Fahnenjunker means a probationary officer cadet. So as a Hitler youth, he had already volunteered to go into the Wehrmacht, and he was as in the Luftwaffe too, which he wanted to follow his brother, and it means he was a probationary officer cadet at the time that he and his fellows were thrown into the battle. And he has written that story, and Willie Chrisman translated it and had always wanted me to edit it, and I didn't have time at the time he was still living and wouldn't do it because I'd done so much. I was tired of just editing other people's work. And then now I met Willie Wenger, and I already had his story, and I did the editing and sent it to the Barnes Review, and they are going to be publishing it. So I'm holding off, you know, I'm not posting it on my own on CarolynJaeger.net until after they have published it in their magazine. I hope that they haven't decided whether to... Well, I won't go into that. Anyway, something about it should be coming up in May. So that's one thing. But the thing I wanted to talk about for just a minute here, because I think it's really important, and I want people to read this material if you haven't already, that I just updated the first one of two, I don't know what to call them, reports that I've posted at CarolynJaeger.net by the Wengers that I got from Willie Wenger. The first one was titled The Days of Our Revolution. It's from the diary of Leopold, who was called Poldi, and he is the one who I've written several times about his fate, died in an air battle over Vienna April, April 1945. So right at the very end, you know, he met his end. So he was a tremendous pilot, fighter pilot and hero, and totally committed, great and handsome, just a Mr. Perfect, you know, seemed to me. But that's the story. But he kept a diary over a long period of time. Well, he only lived to be 23, but and his family has it, and I've got a lot more to publish from him. But right now I updated what I first published for the anniversary of the Anschluss. I wanted to get that in there, so I published. I got a part of it translated by my dear friend Hasso Kastrup, who's been doing all this fantastic translation for me. You know, I just can't thank him enough, and he's been keeping up with it. I can't believe how fast he is, you know, doing it. It's just wonderful. I hope it keeps going. He also has a site up now where he's translating revisionist work, and it is called Show a Blogger. Well, I don't have it right in front of me, but I've written something about that on CarolynJaeger.net also. But back to I'm going to get in too many places here. Back to the Wengers. I did post from March 8th to March 20th from Leopold Wenger's diary. And now, just last night, I was able to get it all together, and I added the earlier part starts at February 12th now, goes through March 20th, as it did before. And very, very interesting about the times, what was happening in their Austrian village. It's not, was, they didn't live in a village. They lived in one of the, it wasn't a big city, but it was a city, Leoben. It was the second city after Graz, which was which is the capital of Styria. So it wasn't a big city, but it was a important city. And that's where they were, their family was located, where they grew up. And so that has now been updated, but I didn't move it forward, so it's still where it was. And it will eventually not be on the front page. So I do want people to go and look for it and realize that it's there. Of course, if you're looking for any specific thing on my website, you can use the search engine and search for certain names, and the list of what articles that have these names in them should come up for you. So you can search for, you know, Wenger, Willy Wenger, and Leopold Wenger, just that, and then, you know, anything, parts of the title that you know about will pop up for you, so you can find it. That now, the second thing that I posted from the Wengers is Willie's own writing. And this Willie, he spells his name W-I-L-L-Y. His family always spelled it that way, although most Willies, excuse me, I've got a cough. Most Willies in German write it W-I-L-L-I, unless it's been kind of like Americanized, but I don't know. The I is the common thing, but Willy Wenger's always been W-I-L-L-Y. So I can distinguish when I talk about one Willie or the other, but it all sounds the same to you. Anyway, this one was entitled The Great Hope, the German Reich, and it was, again, a part of something that Willie wrote about that time period himself. And let me say that the one I was just telling you about has quite a lot of pictures, and I'm still not satisfied. I have more pictures to choose from, and I'm going to work some on the pictures on that one, but I haven't had the time to do it. So but now this one, The Great Hope, the German Reich by Willy Wenger, is just the first part of what I have, and I've now received the rest of the English translation from Hasso on this one, and I will be, but I won't be able to get to that immediately. I've got too many things to do. But this is the part that I have published already is very popular, and people are really, a lot of people are reading it. I have a lot of reads. There's a lot of reads on it, and I'm not surprised, because I have read, every time I go and look at it, I start reading it again. I just can't get enough of it. It's very beautiful. It has some pictures too. And at the bottom, it has these three little pictures of the Wenger men, Willie as just a dearest boy, and their father, who was a wonderful man, and his brother Poldi, and they're all in their uniforms, and they're all National Socialists, and they were all working for the annexation with Germany, and we're very happy when that came about. So you get the feeling of all that as you read these. And I do want, again, I've just got these now as posts on kind of like on the blog there, and eventually they'll go off the front page. So I want people to realize that they're there, and I will be adding to the other one too, but I'll probably I'll let people know when I do that, when I add to Willie's. I might make it a totally new post, because although it goes into the elections on April 10th and so on, it follows along from what's already there. All right, so there's much more coming from Leopold Wenger's diaries and from Willy Wenger, and this is the real history from the people who were there. I mean, it's an inside view that you don't get too often, and I'm just very proud, and very glad that that I have made these connections and I can make this possible. And I've copyrighted the material, and I just want people to know about the copyrights that I've put on my everything on my site. That it is that I don't mind if people take repost what I have there. It should get out as much as possible. I want it to. But I don't want people to just take it and post it on their own, you know, copy it on their own sites or here or there without the proper identification. It's not fair, as I've put a lot of work into this. So have other people. This is Willy Wenger's intellectual property. It becomes, in a sense, also my intellectual property for the part I put into it, or at least I want it. You know, I want to be credited, not me, but you know, where it comes from, and that has to be done. So this copyright means that you can't copy it without written permission from me, and all that requires is that you just tell me, just write to me, Carolyn Yeager, carolyn@carolynyeager.net, and tell me that you want to copy it to your site, and I just want to make sure that you will not just put a link to it, but that you will introduce it by however you want to do it, but who's written it and where it came from and what it's from and so on, and give credit to all this, because that's the only right way to do it. And these are standards that must be upheld in our truth community. We can't just take things as though everything is free because it's on the internet. It doesn't work that way. There are some things that are just being passed around that are not, that one person is just, if stuff that's just being passed around, where everybody can pass it around. But if it's something that is more unique and it is means it's a lot of work from certain people, then that needs to be recognized, and that needs to be always mentioned along with it. So another thing I want to say before I get started with my actual topics is that I want to note the passing of a great warrior for our cause for the truth, which is Douglas Christie. Douglas Christie's funeral was Friday. I did not know him, and so I have not said anything about him up till now, but I certainly knew of him, and I believe that I wrote to him once about being a guest on this very Heretics Hour program, thinking that he certainly fit the profile of a heretic, but I don't remember if he answered me or not. I think maybe he did and had some reason. He was too busy, or he didn't feel like he could do it. It was quite a long time ago, so I don't quite remember. But it was okay. I kind of have the memory that he felt it might not be the best thing for him to be on my program, and I can understand that very, very, very well. So I didn't, you know, feel bad about it, and I didn't ask him again. But we need people like him, you know, and he was a very, very busy man, and he was so busy because there was no one else like him. You know, if we had a number of attorneys like him who were as committed as he was, how wonderful it would be for us. But everybody has to go to him to get help, legal help, because there's nobody else who's really doing it. He was born in Winnipeg, Canada. Of course, he was always a Canadian, in 1946, the year after the war ended. And since 1970, he lived in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he maintained a sole proprietorship law practice in an age of large legal corporations. But he just did his own independent thing, and he occupied a humble office the size of two parking spaces across from the courthouse. His practice initially focused on criminal law, but he later developed a passionate interest in freedom of expression and civil liberties. You know, he embodied the true spirit of pro bono publico, which meant representing clients of little means to ensure they had a voice. We know how he did this. He was a born defense lawyer, they say, brilliant cross-examiner, and a tenacious arguer. He appeared in the Supreme Court of Canada for the issue of free expression, as they call it there. We call it free speech, more times than any other counsel in Canada to date. And he defended, of course, landmark cases of which Ernst Zundel was the one that I'm most familiar with, and everybody knows about that one. He was Ernst Zundel's lawyer, I think one of them, but maybe the main one. And also the other people, some of the famous people he defended was the Keekstra case, Malcolm Ross case, John Ross Taylor, Canadian Liberty Net, and Finta. I don't know much about all of those, but these were all before the Supreme Court of Canada. He took these to the Supreme Court of Canada. And up until the time of his death, he continued to advise clients around the world on publication and free speech issues. In fact, it said that 2.5 weeks before he died, he was struggling to finish a jury trial, fighting pain and nausea, but he wanted to finish the trial that he was currently engaged in to the best of his ability. Now, here's something I never knew. You know, I find myself having more to say about him than I thought I would. In 1978, he created a political movement called the Western Canada Concept. It was for the independence of Western Canada. He was a major advocate of Western Canadian independence. He spoke in hundreds of meetings, mostly in little towns and the cities of Western Canada. He went on talk shows, schools and universities, associations of all types, and would speak. And, for example, in July of 1981, he gave 36 speeches in 30 days, traveling throughout BC and Alberta, advocating Western Canadian separation. I thought that was very interesting, since we are currently talking and thinking about separation here in the United States. And he created this in 1978. He saw a need to have a freer Western Canada. And he also ran in many provincial and federal elections. And he always took the opportunity to express his political opinions wherever he was. This is one heck of a man, and it's a great loss. It's a great loss to us, and certainly to his loved ones. But all right, now I'm going to talk about donations because I had an inspiration about why so many people who have something to sell, even if it's just information, like us at the White Network and my other sites, and also other people with similar sites, who are just trying to get across information. But people who have something to sell can be very aggressive about donations. And I've been critical of that. But what brought it to my mind was that, I'm thinking about big Jewish organizations mostly, like the ADL and its parent B'nai B'rith, and the American Jewish Congress and World Jewish Congress, and the American Jewish Committee, because it was that website that I was looking at, the American Jewish Committee, some days ago when I got my inspiration. Because these organizations, I think, have to be very well funded, even if they don't receive a dime from online donations at their sites. You know, if nobody donated them from, you know, for like people donate to us, it wouldn't hurt them at all. I mean, they wouldn't go out of business. I mean, they've got tons of money and support from international jewelry and from other many other sources where they get their funds. But at the same time, I noticed how they had this big word donate, you know, in a prominent place on this site, and it's the same on all their sites, and the text that expresses how much, you know, sometimes they have text that says, oh, you know, keep us going, please donate, and so on. Well, you think, well, what do they need? Why do they need money? Well, then I realized that the key to all these fake donation schemes, in one way, you know, okay, I'm going to skip that part. As I was looking at this big donate word at the American Jewish Committee website, I realized why they do it, why they all do it. this is something Jews know better than we do. They know that when someone donates their own hard-earned money, they become a supporter too. They have made an investment, you know, at this point. And it's like any investment. You want the one that you're, what you're investing in to succeed. It's a kind of a psychological thing. You might not be thinking about that at all, but it happens psychologically. Like, you know, a bond has been forged, however light, between the giver and the receiver. Now that they've given you some money, which can be hard to part with for people, you know, it means a lot, even if it's a small amount of money. It means a lot to them. And if they decided to give it to you, they then have more of an interest in you. They're kind of in your corner rather than in someone else's corner who might have gotten that money instead, but instead they gave it to you. So there's they're more likely also to give again, I think, once they've given once, because repetition rules most of us more than we want to believe. And whatever we've done one time, it's easier to do it the second time in everything. And then even easier to do it the third time, and so on. And so we get into a habit real easily. But it's not just the money, as I'm saying. Getting people to donate to you increases your influence with them through their increased identification with you, which can be more important than the money. So for Jewish organizations like the ones I mentioned and many others, it is more important, I think. It is more important for them to have people thinking about them and, you know, as a donor, they will be thinking about them and feel more identified with them. So the moral of the story for me is that I should want to have as many donors as possible. I shouldn't be modest about it or afraid that I'll look greedy. And white people, I think, are very self-conscious about that. We don't want to look greedy. And I know a lot of people with sites who are very hesitant to ask for money. And if you don't really need it, you think, well, why should I be asking? But I was just really struck by this idea of how donating identifies you with the site. And the more people that say would donate to Carolyn Yeager or to the White Network or to Elie Wiesel Cons the World, I realize that these people are then going to pay more attention, going to take what I say more seriously, are going to care more about supporting the site in other ways. And that's all very, very valuable. So I think the Jews are onto something where they never quit asking for money because they know that it works this way. And I think we need to catch on to this and not be afraid to do so. So then we're all going to be... I know there's a lot of good white people who are... I've been critical of them, but, you know, they're not like the Jews, who take this keeping donations going very seriously. And I think it helps their cause. It helps people to think about them, to read them, to pay attention to them. And so it makes sense that you'd be doing that. So, that's my idea here. So I'm going to say, folks, donate, donate here, donate to the White Network. I'm saying, if you send $5 donation, every other month or so, you know, something that will perhaps make you one of our investors and more invested in what we're doing here. And I have to want that to happen. So I'm not going to be afraid to talk about this, anymore. And also I want to thank, so far in March, we've had a contribution from three people, William from Virginia, Carl from Minnesota, and Edwin from the Netherlands. So we're not taking in much, ladies and gentlemen, but that's why I say a small amount every so often is sufficient, perhaps, if you're not a rich person, to make you feel like you're a part of what's going on here and feel like you've invested something in it. And so that's good. And now let me go on to... the Jews and their rights. Here on the International Jew, we've been having chapters about this lately. And then on Saturday, I had Kevin MacDonald and Tan Stoffel talking about this Jewish person, Lawrence Oster, and we got on to so much about their demand for their rights and everything that they want and how they attack us, you know, if they don't get it. And so I have, you know, there's always so many sick stories every week about Jewish groups demanding this or that. So there were some I just couldn't resist for tonight. I've got a couple of them here, three of them, I think. Anyway, today I went to the Daily Caller because of a link somebody sent me. And, you know, that's really a horrible website because these advertisements start attacking you as soon as you go there. I had a hard time copying this little short article because these ads kept jumping in front of me. I don't know. So there you have people who are selling. You know, I think if you sell advertising and they can put on advertising that gets in the way of your reading so that you can't not see it, you know, and you have to deal with it, they must get more money for that. And people who allow that on their sites, I think I don't have any respect for them, but you know, there's a lot of people just get into where they get popular and then they just want to make a lot of money, as much money as they can. I'm not saying they get rich on it, anyway, some of these advertisements, some sites have too much advertising and the advertising is too aggressive. But anyway, at the Daily Caller, there was this story, Jewish Democrat group denounces Rand Paul's CPAC straw poll. So here we've got this absolutely ridiculous story where the National Jewish Democratic Council's executive director, Aaron Kiyak, stopped just short of declaring Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul anti-Semitic and warned that American Jews should be alarmed that Paul won yesterday's conservative political action conference presidential straw poll. Well, now, what kind of democracy is this? This is the National Jewish Democratic Council. I think they're associated with the Democratic Party. And, you know, they have these party straw polls and so on. I don't know. CPAC is something to do with conservatives. So I guess he won the conservatives. The conservatives preferred him. And so these national Jewish Democratic, these Jews in this organization, are protesting against this. And so, you know, here's what they say. American Jews should be alarmed that the Republican Party's core activists have selected Senator Rand Paul to be their preferred standard bearer for 2016. Senator Paul has called multiple times to cut and end American aid to Israel and has refused to rule out a containment strategy vis-a-vis Iran. So because they don't agree with his policies that he's putting forth, they come out and say that he should be, what do they say? They say that well, everybody should be alarmed and, well, let's see if they say anything more here. They say that he's dangerous. You know, his policy views are nothing short of dangerous, and his growing legitimacy among the GOP's base is another reason why the vast majority of Jewish Americans consistently support the Democratic Party. Well, they're not coming out and saying he should be, you know, thrown out or anything like that. Of course, he's been elected by the people of his district. But they're interfering in such a way that, you know, it's like, oh, nobody can be for him because we the Jews don't like what he stands for. And they're even in a different party. You know, and we know how they interfere with Ron Paul's victories and in those straw polls. No matter how many straw polls Ron Paul won, he never won anything else. And now they're doing it to his son, Rand Paul. Now, I'm not supporting these people, but you know, they're better than a lot of the people we have. And anyway, this rejection of conservative America's right to have a voice is what it is. These Jews absolutely come out and reject that conservative Americans have a right to have a voice. I mean, it's just totally unacceptable. So then another story that was, let's see, what is today? World Jewish Congress. World Jewish Congress urges Greek action against neo-Nazis. So now these World Jewry, you know, in their World Jewish Congress, on Sunday, they sent a strong message of solidarity to the Jewish community of Greece. What they're saying is that they're commemorating the 70th anniversary of the first deportation of Salonican Jews to the death camps, you know, the Holocaust stuff. And so it's been 70 years, and they're trying to make a big deal there in Greece. And they're saying that the Golden Dawn Party needs to be outlawed. Once again, they're going totally against democracy, and they do it under the guise of democratic action, you know, of supporting, of being the holders of the democratic mantle or something. And in this case, the World Jewish Congress president is Ronald S. Lauder. He never goes away, you know, the heir of the Estee Lauder cosmetic firm. And he's always been very, very active in Zionist and World Jewish organizations and issues and so on. And he was big in the idea that they had to raise money to preserve the crumbling crematoriums, which they call gas chambers, in the Birkenau memorial there, because they have to last forever so that people can be reminded of what happened there and so on. That's him. He's big. He's filthy rich, and he's a big money raiser for the Jews. And he was kind of the head guy, because the World Jewish Congress organized this whole thing for the Salonican Jews, this whole thing in Greece about this 70th anniversary. They're behind it, and they got the current Prime Minister Samaras to come to their big meeting on Sunday and give a talk. Well, yeah, because I have a picture of him at the speaker's podium. And, you know, it says that he was the first sitting Greek prime minister for 100 years to visit a synagogue. This thing was held in the synagogue. And it's really weird looking in there, because there's all kinds of, you know, Jewish symbology and so on. And, you know, they probably kind of tricked him into speaking. They invited him. He couldn't probably say no. And he said some things. He said his government would do everything to rein in the extremists. What else is he going to say? And he would enact a legislation that will be completely intolerant to violence and racism. Well, when you say racism, read anti-Semitism. They have to call it racism, you know. And so on. Well, he's not a friend. You know, he's not a friend of the Golden Dawn either. He's the European Union pick for prime minister, but he was there doing that. But the thing is that the main thing they were saying there was attacking Golden Dawn, and Lauder urged Greece, you know, telling them these little number of Jews in Greece, you know, but oh, they're going to tell everybody. I've talked about this before, what a small number of Jews is in Greece, and yet they think they should tell all the Greeks what to do. You have to take decisive action against the growing neo-Nazi movement Golden Dawn. He called them the new Nazis and a threat to democracy. So they are a threat to democracy, but they want to, you know, they don't follow democracy by wanting to shut people up. But they say, they make out that these people are some kind of dangerous extremists, and therefore it's okay to do that, you know. Actually, in their resolution, they called on Greece to consider banning extremist parties such as Golden Dawn. So again, you know, this is totally not democratic, but it's what goes on in Germany. They're trying to get this kind of thinking in as many European countries as they can. And you know, this meeting was 50 Jewish community heads and representatives from around the world attended. So this was a World Jewry organized event. And they made it happen because they got all these Jews to come from all around the world, make it look like, you know, it was real important and a lot of people there. And then they lie about, okay, they say more than, let's see. Okay, well, now that's I'm thinking about something somewhere else. And the last thing here is that they managed to get 3,000 people to participate in a commemorative march organized by Thessalonica's mayor, Greek mayor. Well, you know, see, they bring these people's names in, even though these people might not have be really behind it. But they have to kind of go along with it, and then they make out like the mayor organized it. Huh. I imagine they organized it, and they could find 3,000 Jews to march in this parade, and a few, they can find some non-Jews, too, who will do it. And now, the last one is that on March 15th, the University of Aachen in Germany fired a Romanian historian, Vladimir Iliescu, for simply claiming that the Holocaust never happened in Romania. You know, there are a lot of Romanians who insist that Romania was not part of the Holocaust and the Jews were not treated there. They're not going to defend Germany or Hungary. They're kind of competitive, Romania and Hungary. So, but they insist that that they were not a part of it. And here's what they say, that this historian, this Romanian historian, has said, and this is what he's so much in trouble for, he said that 20,000 Jews died, but this is not a Holocaust. And for that, he got into all this trouble. And the official death count put out by the Yad Vashem Museum Memorial in Israel has that number, and this is the official, you know, narrative too, is that 380,000 to 400,000 Jews were murdered in Romanian-controlled territory. And now, this is, though, during the rule of Antonescu, so this would be during Stalinist and the Soviet time too, I believe, but they call it all the Holocaust. And anyway, that's a big difference. You know, he says 20,000 and they say 400,000. So this kind of thing goes on. But he's trying to speak out for Romania, but he didn't get very far. However, I don't like when they want to say, oh, the Germans and the Hungarians perpetrated a Holocaust, but we didn't, you know. I'm going to go on now to Charles Kraft. You know, Charles is still in the news, and that's a very good thing, as I said in the beginning. And what strikes me as so ludicrous in these stories that I read about him, because there's always a lot of comments to them, is the emotional reaction expressed by the majority of those who are reacting to this story, and their acceptance that the Holocaust must not be questioned. I mean, we're all familiar with that. You know, people who write at the end of these articles and so on, I mean, they don't really know anything about it. They've never investigated. They've never studied it. But they accept that it must not be questioned. And anybody who questions it is, a evil person, a neo-Nazi, or mentally ill, or stupid, or, you know, as Tan says, stupid, crazy, evil. But they never, you know, these, and when it comes to the Charles Kraft story, these are supposed to be some of the elite, if I might call it that, again, tongue in cheek, but, you know, the people who think of themselves as, you know, they follow art, they follow intellectual articles, they read a lot and so on. I don't know. And they're no different. They're probably worse. They're so totally indoctrinated in this thing. It's just quite amazing. Now, Charles did an interview with Studio 360 on a public radio, national public radio of some type, and this fellow, Kurt Anderson, is the host, and he talked about Charles a few weeks ago, and then they did an interview. And what struck me here, for one thing, is that this interview, he said at the end, which I'll tell you right now, that the interview lasted for 40 minutes. It was a telephone interview with this Kurt Anderson, the host of the show, and, you know, it was just being recorded, wasn't live, and Charles Kraft. And then he said that they only used 7 minutes, because that's how long the little the little show was, you know, that he put on, because he has various topics and so on. So Charles got 7 minutes, and they talked for 40 minutes. So, you know, you can imagine how much they cut out. And that means why I wouldn't even do a thing like that. You know, I mentioned that to Charles before he was going to do it. I said, you know, they're going to tape it, and then they're going to cut it all up and, you know, and post and put on what they want. Yeah, he knew that, but he thought it might, you know, be an opportunity to give his side. But, you know, I was, when I listened to it, and I thought it was okay. And then as I started to write about it more today, I thought I had some disappointment in it. I had some disappointment in the way Charles, you know, what Charles said. But then when I got to that last part and I realized, you know, you said that it was 40 minutes and they only used 7, then I know that we don't know what Charles said. They used what they wanted. That's all. And Charles really comes across quite well, but, you know, he could have come across stronger, but probably if he did say a lot of the things I would have liked him to say, or maybe he even did say them, they're not going to put those in there. So let me cover a little bit about what was in this show. I imagine some of you have listened to it. You go to, I don't know if I have the URL here for this or not. It looks like, I don't, but it's, if you just Google, PRI radio, Charles Kraft, it'll come up and you can listen to it. And there's a kind of an article there about it, which I have copied here, which is not word for word, but it gives a lot of what was said there and reminds me of what was said. But, Charles said to Kurt Anderson this is part of what was on, that they allowed to be on the air. I knew that these were hot symbols, you know, these Nazi symbols that he was using. He, you know, said again he'd been working with this Slovenian group, and they used a lot of this stuff, and that's what got him thinking about using them. And then he, you know, found that he could use them too in his ceramics quite effectively, and so that's how that got started. And, you know, he said, I was using these symbols before I was a Holocaust denier. He says he's not a Holocaust denier. He's a Holocaust skeptic, but of course, you know, when people are talking about being a Holocaust denier, you start using their language, and who knows what context this was in, or, you know, what he was saying before this or after that. But in this one line on the program, he does use Holocaust denier, which just came out somehow, because that's what people call him. And he says, I wasn't even interested in the Holocaust really at the time he started using these symbols. And then he, Charles, being a curious person and being, you know, running into a lot of things, he started looking into it, as we all, many of us know, because we've been familiar with him for a while now, you know, in forums and comment boards and stuff. But he does make this point. He did get the point across on the radio program that he doesn't buy this thing about the, you know, because the guy's asking him, well, how can you, you know, how can you question this, blah, blah. And Charles says, I just don't buy this thing about 2,000 people a day being gassed at Auschwitz. It doesn't add up to me technologically. And then I thought, well, I wish Charles had pursued this more and really pushed some some claims, you know, put this Kurt Anderson on the defensive a little bit. But then, you know, I know that if he had, it wouldn't probably, they don't have to put it on the air, do they? You know, I mean, 7 minutes out of 40 minutes tells you the story. That's less than a quarter of what he said. So, and part of it was Kurt talking. So, Kurt asks about, they talked about the Hitler teapot. That seems to be the main item of interest. And Charles said, he thought that Hitler has been demonized excessively. You know, he says he's not a Nazi, but he's changed his opinion of Adolf Hitler since he's been looking into the history of everything. And he doesn't have a bad opinion of him anymore. He thinks he's been demonized. And he says the teapot started out ironical and is, but then he said, if you look at that teapot, it's goofy. I don't think it's goofy. I like that Hitler teapot. And somebody brought up in the comments, well, I'm going to read that. I'll wait till I read that. But another thing that this Kurt Anderson did was to tell Kraft that his career was wrecked. He writes here, Kraft's public embrace of Holocaust denial is likely to wreck his career as a respected artist. But on the show, he referred to Kraft's wrecked career. He was summing something up, and he said, your wrecked career, you know, as though it's a done deal. And I guess for him, as a public radio guy, that's what they think. That's what they want. People want Kraft's career to be wrecked by this. But I don't think it's going to be. And I hope that he will have, you know, he had a platform here, but it was not a fair platform because as what I've already said. So I would hope that maybe some more platforms will come up for him and that he will be able to state things more boldly and it will get across because, you know, this is what we need here. We need somebody who's got some basis for being respected and for accomplishing things and still has these views and doubts the Holocaust story and also doesn't go along with the demonization of Hitler so much. But now, then they very openly started to paint him as mentally ill, you know, as he's got some problem. Because Kurt then, wonders right on the air there that maybe Kraft needs some help, emotional help. Maybe he's, and so Kraft laughs and says, laughed at that. He says, well, nobody's said that I'm crazy, although somebody wrote that I might be getting senile. And so then he asked this guy if he thought he needed some psychiatric help, if that's what he was getting at. And Kurt says, well, he thought if he was his friend, he would advise him to go look for some psychiatric help. Maybe that's what he needed. And Kraft says, well, if I find a psychiatrist that can help me, I'll get back to you and let you know. After this little article, and then of course they also have you can play the tape, but this article was written by Kurt Anderson's superiors, and also the tape that they played was edited by them too. It wasn't edited by Kurt Anderson. So you know how it is. He interviews people for 40 minutes, and then it goes to the editors, the higher up than him, and they decide what's going to go on and what isn't. And so he writes a note. Kurt Anderson does after this thing that's written by his superiors on the website, and he says interviewing a Holocaust denier, he says, is a delicate piece of broadcasting. Many listeners who commented below find it inappropriate that we gave him any airtime at all. That is the people in the long comments section, you know, who right away, oh, why do you even put this guy on the air? It's just terrible. And then he says, Kurt Anderson says, but as a major artist whose work has used imagery that, given his new beliefs, not now seems to take on a vastly different meaning, meaning that we allowed him to speak from his own viewpoint. Well, they didn't allow him much. But he says that, so they're saying, what this comes down to is that they're saying, and this is what I discussed with Charles when he was on the program with me, it changes the work's value or acceptability if the artist's political views are not within the realm of public acceptance. And this should be challenged. And I wish Charles had been able to challenge it, and maybe he did, and they didn't put it on. But, you know, what about Piss Christ and the Golden Tower that I told you about a while back, all those jars of urine that were piled up and light put on them at night, and that was made a work of art. And the Stalinist, a Stalinist person, what if you had someone who was a Stalinist putting Bolshevik Stalin images on his artwork? But nobody would care. Nobody would care. And there's a special thing about Hitler and Holocaust because it's the Jews. So you know it's from the Jews. You know it's the Jews who are doing it. And one thing is, okay, I covered that, is that this idea that he wants to say that he says to suggest, he says that to provide a sense, what they wanted to do in this show was to provide a sense of Mr. Kraft's state of mind and personality, how his artistic practice, which included Nazi iconography, led him to his peculiar beliefs in late middle age. Okay, I'll go on a little more with that when we get back.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on March 18th, 2013. And I want to remind you that that was Frank Reneke singing his own song, Heldengedanken. You know, and last Saturday, and I've done this on several Saturday of my Saturday programs. I say, well, I think the music that's coming up is Frank Reneke. I can't seem to remember the other one, or I can't keep it straight which is which. But I think now, after doing that several times, I think I've got it straight now, and I won't do that again. This is where repetition comes in, and it takes getting, you know, getting used to something before it sticks, at least in my mind anymore. So I was discussing Charles Kraft, and I want to remind you that you can now call in if you want to and comment on any of the things I've talked about in the first hour. The number is 1-830-443-4911. And that number is always on the front page of the White Network website. But I'll repeat it, 1-830-443-4911. Now, Charles Kraft, you know, I was rushing through that before we went to the break, saying that they clearly wanted to suggest that there's some mental instability here with Charles, and also that maybe his age, which is now 65, and at the time, let's say 5 years ago when he was doing some of this, he was 60, that somehow, you know, he had gotten a little weak in the head because of his age. I mean, it's really amazing. And again, you have to see Jews behind this. I mean, there's no reason that if somebody is, if you decide somebody's anti-Semitic, that you can't just say, well, they're anti-Semitic. You don't have to make them evil. You don't have to make them, mentally ill. But this is the Jewish, way of doing it. They can't allow that to be a choice that a person might make, you know, a sensible choice I shouldn't say sensible, they would, but you know, just in their freedom of choice, that might be the way somebody sees things, and it doesn't make them bad, or doesn't make them mentally have it that way. They have to have it that way. So you know that even when we see that there's just people who aren't Jews, you know, going along with all of this, it seems to be always the Jewish agenda, the Jewish narrative that we find being promoted. So there you go. Because they say that, I will add that the commenter, the host wrote, and to the commenter, he's talking about these people commenting on his program, who asked if I would similarly question the mental states of fervent birthers and believers in extraterrestrial visitations. Yes, I would. In fact, in one part of my conversation with Mr. Kraft that we didn't air, I compared Holocaust denialism to a belief that the Earth is flat and said that geophysicists holding such opinions are excluded from serious discourse and denied jobs in the academy. He, meaning Charles, agreed the analogy was apt. I sure hope he didn't. I find it hard to believe that Charles would agree with that. He may have said something that this man took as agreement and then was able to write about, because it would be a bad thing for Charles to agree that Holocaust denialism was the same as flat earth theory. But he may probably was agreeing to the way the guy worded it, that this was the way it was seen. And this guy shifts it around to say that he agreed with it, period. And I'm quite sure I know Charles well enough that he wouldn't agree with that. So these people are not to be trusted, not at all. They are the most sneaky, dishonest people. I wonder what good it does to try to get a to try to be able to speak in the mainstream, because everybody who's done it hasn't really gained much from it. Of course, if you can actually be on live, that's one thing. But if they're going to record and edit, then, you know, you don't have a chance. But I hope we hear more. I'm going to comment on these comments here. I've just copied down four of them. There's a whole bunch of them, and it's a whole, you know, a lot of interesting ones. But I just found four that I thought were interesting, and I didn't want to spend any more time, you know, on them on the show. So, but I have enough time before I go into the Ford, the different translations of Mein Kampf. Well, I'm really not going to talk about a lot of different translations. I'm only going to talk about the two that that I know of. I mean, I know the Murphy translation because that's the one I have. And, I've been studying up on this new Ford translation. But before I go on to that, I'm going to comment a little bit on these comments. So one person wrote, from Austria. This is somebody who gives his name, Dijon, from Austria. He says, "I am a black person. Have to say this. Well, I'm glad this aired, because if it did not, I would not know about this person. But when I saw he made a Charles Manson piece, that told me all I need to know about this person. He is not dumb, just playing the stupid card." Now, this black person goes on to say, okay, he says he has been working with Slovenische, I forgot the Kunst, that Slovenian group, a.k.a. the band Laibach. Laibach has always took the piss out of the concept of nationalism. Is that right? I don't really know. The new art is making its own country, and he gives a link to nskstate.com. Says this is only an art joke, but people take it for real. I don't know what he's referring to, but what got me was his last sentence, okay? He says, "Now, I have to say, I have been to Slovenia. The people are super nice, not racist, compared to Austria, which is super racist." Now, you know, this is like this woman that I talked about last week, the woman from Kyrgyzstan, whatever it was, who's been living in Austria for 34 years and taking advantage of all the good things in Austria. Excuse me. And then complaining about the people there and how she thinks they don't treat her well enough because she's Jewish. Now, this black person is certainly not an Austrian. This can really get my ire up. He is not an Austrian. I don't know, but he's there in Austria, living there, and these people are, and the Austrians, of course, are very polite people, even though they don't really like immigration. They don't want, you know, all these people there, but they would be too nice to be rude to them. At least I wish they'd be more rude than they are, but he's there taking advantage of all that. But then when he gets an opportunity, he puts them down and calls them racist and super racist. You know, well, then why doesn't he leave? You know, boy, I wish I could get my hands on this guy. This is one guy that really makes me mad. If I could get my hands on him, because I can't, I'm not up to fighting a man. Well, he's probably a man, even a woman. But if I had a chance, I would do a lot of damage to this person. I would. Now we have Sam from Devon in the UK. He's much nicer. He says, has anyone noticed with the Hitler teapot, you can see his eyes as either open or closed? And that's what I had thought. When the one that Charles said that his eyes were blank. The eyes were open, but there was no eyeballs there or anything, irises. I didn't realize that because I'd only seen pictures of it, one picture. I'd never seen it in real life, so I thought that the eyes were closed, and this person thought the same thing. And he says, see them as open, and he is the demonic extremity we all expect. See them as closed, he is suddenly strangely human and sympathetic. Well, I thought it looked like he was meditating. And he says, but he says that either way, he says, I got to say, I reckon it's pretty good. It's a good piece. As for the artist's personal views, doesn't worrying about what he really thinks belong to people who read the label at the side before they look at the work? I thought that was so good. Of course, it's what would come to your mind because people do that. In art shows, people go and read about what they're looking at because they don't know what they're looking at a lot of times today. So they have to see what it says so they know, you know, how to understand it. And he's saying that, he says, surely you should engage with the work and not what it means to you first. You should just, you know, experience the work before you read about what somebody says it means. And he says, if we're worried about a teapot convincing people to convert to neo-Nazism, then these are truly worrying times. Well, you know, I don't think anybody thinks that the teapot will do that. They just don't want to give any kind of recognition to someone who doesn't believe in the Holocaust and says so. Just, you know, if they find out, if he never said that, Charles, and even if people who knew him knew that, but it never became really public or whatever, then nobody would have cared, you see. But since it's become public, they just can't allow it. So all this stuff happens. Then Frederick Tobin wrote in. He wrote a very good comment. He said, isn't it interesting that so-called Holocaust denial is a crime when, in fact, the Professor Robert Forson challenge remains standing, which is, quote, show me or draw me the homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz. Some of you are familiar with that Forson put out that challenge, quite some years ago, and nobody's ever done it. And Frederick says, now don't let yourself get upset by this challenge. That sounds like Fred. But take it up and do what to date no one has done. The murder weapon does not exist. And he signs his name. So, and he's from Australia. So I don't know if anybody responded to that, at least right following that. I didn't see a response. And I took these at least 3 days ago. So I haven't looked since, so I don't know what new stuff has been added. But the last one I'm going to mention is Philip Nicholas from New York wrote, he says, museums like libraries should not burn books and should not burn or hide art. What they should both do, and usually do, notwithstanding public outrage, is discuss the work. And he says, I'm thinking Piss Christ and Elephant Dung Madonna. Now, of course, we've talked about Piss Christ before, but there was also Elephant Dung Madonna. Yeah, it was as I recall it, it was some images, the same one, put here and there on a canvas, of the Black Madonna, you know, like, not the Virgin of Guadalupe, but some Black Madonna that's some famous image, you know, a Negro Madonna, and maybe art. It was a piece of art like from Negro type art. I can't say that for sure. I don't remember, but I have seen it, and it had elephant dung stuck here and there on it. It had these images of the Black Madonna here and there, and I had this elephant dung stuck here and there. Just a way, you know, you have to say to insult Christianity and the figure of the Virgin Mother and so on, you know, in the worst way you can. And these are both being shown around, and, you know, people are being outraged by them and so on. And this Philip writes, if the work contains hate, identify the hate contained in it. If the work is merely offensive, discuss who is offended by it. But if the work is pretty much universally reviled because it is universally viewed as wrong or evil, make the public aware, which will help the public never forget. If I were a private collector, I would not want to own such a creation, he says. But if I were a curator, you know, in a museum, I would want to display Kraft's work in the full sanitizing light of the sun. Well, obviously, he doesn't approve of Kraft's work, but he thinks by showing it, it will make people aware of hate and evil and so on, if that's what it contains. So you have all kinds of variety of views there, and I didn't really copy down any of the worst ones that are there, the stupidest ones. But I have something else here So I looked up Piss Christ to see where it was now. You know, that's the photograph of the image of Christ stuck in a jar of urine or a glass of urine or something. You know, just stupid. And I didn't know what had happened to it. And that the latest I could find was that in September 2012, it was in a group show at a New York gallery. And this, the artist of this, you call him an artist, Andres Serrano, he did this in 1987, and it was a photograph. Yeah, it's a photograph. And he's having a retrospective. That's it. And so they're including it. And it's there at that gallery, being shown. It was shown in that retrospective. And they say here, now here's what they say, this art gallery. And this is perfectly acceptable to everybody. The fact that this work continues to draw controversy on both sides of the political, social, and religious aisles, unfortunately, overshadows the artist's intention, which is to engage the viewer on both a visual and intellectual level. Now that's, isn't that what Charles Kraft is doing? How you could certainly put it that way. You could say his intention is to engage the viewer. All artists' intention is to engage the viewer, and usually on a visual and intellectual level, certainly on a visual level. And unfortunately, sometimes it's purely intellectual level with no visual level being considered. You know, there's not much visual there, like with Piss Christ, although it's something that you see with your eyes. You have to see it to know what it is, but still, it's not visually appealing, or it's not, you know, anything, any kind of real visual. What would you say? We used to think of art as a visual feast, but now it's not. But so then it goes on to say, in these times of heated religious fervor, it is important to remember that freedom of expression remains dear to any democracy. You know, freedom, let's remember that freedom of expression remains dear to any democracy when we're faced with things like Piss Christ by Andres Serrano, who is probably some kind of a very much left winger. So that is just, you know, that is just what can be said about that? It's not, that's not true when it applies to someone who is has expressed right wing views or anything to do with nationalism or white preference for white people or pro-whiteness, or of course Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust and so on. So there we go. And I think this I know I've kind of gone over this quite a few times, but I think this debate on the level of art, and you know, art is in bad shape these days. It's true, but we still call it that. So this debate on the level of art is a very good place to take it. It's really important, and I hope it can keep going, and that's why I bring it up. We'll see if Charles gets any more invitations to to be interviewed by somebody in the mainstream or semi-mainstream. Now, you know, if you say, well, why didn't you have Charles on here today instead of just you? Well, I did. I did invite Charles to come on tonight's program. Actually, I invited Charles on last Saturday's program. But he just doesn't want to come on too often. You know, he doesn't want to overdo it, you know, so he thought it was too soon. So, but I don't want people to write to me and say, well, why didn't you, you should have Charles on. Well, you know, I do those things, but it doesn't mean that it works out. Okay. You know, I just came upon some quotations from Mein Kampf on Andrew Agland's, Total Fascism site, which I do follow. And, he had his latest post there, at least it was before the show started, was on libertarianism, but he used some quotes from two quotes from Mein Kampf, and he used the Ford translation. He said, this is the Ford translation. Well, when I read the quotes, I didn't like the sound of them at all. And I thought, what's the Ford translation? I think I may have heard of it, but I really wasn't, paying too much attention or didn't care about it at the time. So I had to look that up, and today I've done a certain amount of research about it, and I have some things that I want to say about this Ford translation and about Mein Kampf and the attitude we should have toward it. So to just get right into it, I'll just say that Andre wrote on his Total Fascism blog. He doesn't like to call it a blog, website. He says he wanted to share a couple of quotes from Hitler. They're from chapter 2 of Mein Kampf, and where he is speaking. Then he puts in parentheses Ford translation. Okay. And he's speaking of his debates with the Social Democrats. Now, I don't quite know how to go about this, because I don't know how much of this to actually read. But what I have, okay, here's what I'll do. The first quote I could not find in my Murphy translation. You know, he's using the Ford translation. And, you know, and then, you know, I wrote a comment after this, and I said, I didn't like this Ford translation, what I see of it, and it seems like a dumbed-down version of Mein Kampf, and this is what I definitely think it is. Dumb. And Bill Fink used the words Mein Kampf for dummies, and Andrew thought that Bill Fink had recommended the Ford translation, but he heard him talking about it when it seems to me that what was going on there in a forum kind of situation, audio one, that Bill got confused about something on his own website where there is a mistake in the I have a hard time when I have to keep repeating these people's names, in the Murphy translation, the James Murphy translation. There does turn out that there's a bad mistake, and somebody wrote Bill Fink about it, because he uses the Murphy translation. He's got the whole thing there in writing and also in audio on his Mein Kampf site at Christogenia. And somebody wrote and said that there was this error, and what it was, and this person who wrote to him was George Held, who has a good reputation, and he is the translator of that book. I don't know if I can remember it. The War with Many Fathers, talking about World War I, I think, maybe both of them, but it's in German, and I guess he translated it into English. I don't. Anyway, I saw that there, and but I didn't write all that down. So and so he's he pointed out this error that Murphy made. And it's just one sentence. And so I have quite a bit about that. I guess on some talk thing, Bill had confused that with the Ford translation, because he mentions, all right, needs a lot of background, but he mentions, where do I have that? The Raynal, this George Held mentions the Raynal Hitchcock translation, and gives that, as the correct one, and then gives his own, correct one, which is a lot shorter than this Raynal Hitchcock. But Bill Fink was thinking that the Raynal Hitchcock translation was the Ford translation. And so he was speaking well of it. But then he told me that, no, he had never read it, that his wife has a copy. His wife likes it. She likes the Ford translation. Well, the Ford translation is simpler. It was written to be simpler. And, so to go back, to the beginning here, in the two translations that, in the two extracts that Andrew had on his site, I couldn't find the first one in my Murphy translation. But I did find, let's see if I've got it here. I've got different. Yeah, okay, here it is. I did find the second one. And the differences are quite dramatic. And, I will say that, what Ford has here is not a real long paragraph, but what Murphy wrote is much, much longer. So Ford shortens it as well as simplifying it. He simplifies it by taking a lot of it out. And I know that there's the argument that people don't read Mein Kampf because they find it too difficult. Well, I don't quite know. I don't know if it's a good idea when it comes to something like Mein Kampf to simplify it so that people who read at the sixth grade level, I'm sorry, you know, because that's what newspapers are written in for the sixth grade level. When I was in sixth grade, I was a pretty good reader. I think sixth graders are not at that level anymore that we used to be at sixth grade. So I don't know what level this would be, but people's reading skills have deteriorated quite a bit. It's true. And I don't know, though, how good of an idea it is to come out with simplified versions of Mein Kampf for these people so that they can know what's in it. I think that it's okay, but only if it's identified as such. Like they have these books, you know, Such and Such for Dummies. I have one that's called, it's about something about the computer, something about the internet for dummies. Well, even that I had a hard time following. So, so it depends on what you're good at, but I've been reading difficult to read books, since I was in high school, and I find that I don't mind, you know. I know it's difficult, but I have a sense of satisfaction, I guess, that when I understand what it means, that the biggest difficulty seems to be that some of the sentences are so long, and people complain. This is one thing I've read, that a sentence ends up being a whole paragraph, and people can't follow the sentence from the beginning to the end. I realize sometimes I can't, you know. If it's really long, I have to go back and say, well, and I think, why don't they cut this sentence in two, for God's sake? You know, this gets to be too hard to follow. But so you have to concentrate a lot. Some people can't do this, so they don't read it. So if you have one, it should be called a Mein Kampf for Dummies. It really should be. But unfortunately, this Ford has presented his version, his translation, as the ultimate, preferred by scholars, you know, and the most eminent one that ever been done, you know, the best one, the new one. I'll get into some of that in a minute, of what he's claimed for his book, which is also, he's also the publisher. He's really not at all qualified to do this, what he's done here. But he's managed to do something that is not absolutely wrong, but he shouldn't really be trusted. So anyway, this particular extract that Andrew took from the chapter 2 in Mein Kampf, which I have here, I have managed to find in the Murphy. He says, no, this is going to be clever. He says, all right, Ford's translation says, the more, well, maybe I should read Murphy's first. And Murphy starts it with this paragraph, with this, the more I debated with them, meaning Jews or Marxists, the more familiar I became with their argumentative tactics. And Ford says, the more disputes I had with them, the better acquainted I became with their arguing techniques. Well, you know, I'd say, well, it says the same thing, means the same thing. But I like the more I debated with them more than the more disputes I had with them. Because it, depending on what's really correct, if he's saying that he's debating with them, you know, I tend to trust the Murphy because it's more complete. It's longer, see. So it takes in everything that Hitler said and wrote. Whereas the other one has been shortened, because it goes from there at the, he leaves out a little bit. Then he says Murphy says, at the outset, they counted upon the stupidity of their opponents, but when they got so entangled that they could not find a way out, they played the trick of acting as innocent simpletons. So he uses the word stupidity, saying that they counted upon the stupidity of their opponents, but when they couldn't succeed in what they were trying to do, they acted as innocent simpletons. Well, then Ford writes, first they would count on the stupidity of their adversaries, and then if there was no way out, they pretended to be stupid themselves. So he uses stupid twice, and it didn't feel right that Hitler would use that word stupid so much. You know, because I not only read this Murphy translation of Mein Kampf, and I read his second book, too, and I read the Mein Kampf. I didn't read the whole thing twice, but I read parts of it twice. And I read a lot of things by Hitler, you know, speeches and so on. And I just have a feeling for, I think, you know, a memory for how he writes. And this just doesn't sound like it at all. And it doesn't have the quality of Hitler's mind. It's too simplified. Now, let's go on to another sentence here that I've got bolded. When they were caught off guard. All right. Let's see. Oop, I didn't mark this, so. Simpletons. No. See, there's a couple sentences here, and then they're not here. So, well, let's say, I'm sorry, I should have marked this. I guess I thought I'd find it. Well, I can't do that one. You might suppose this is one step forward. Well, he goes on, Murphy goes on, should they fail, in spite of their tricks of logic, they acted as if they could not understand the counter-arguments and bolted away to another field of discussion. They would lay down truisms and platitudes, and if you accepted these, then you were applied to other problems and matters of an essentially different nature from the original theme. And if you faced them with this point, they would escape again, and you could not bring them to make any precise statement. Whenever one tried to get a firm grip on any of these apostles, one's hand grasped only jelly and slime, which slipped through the fingers and combined again into a solid mass a moment afterwards. Okay, well, you know how much that was. And what happens with Ford is that after he talks about the pretending to be stupid themselves, he writes, if all else failed, they claimed they did not understand, or being challenged, they would instantly jump to another subject and talk about obvious truths. If these were agreed on, they immediately applied them to entirely different matters. When they were caught off guard, they would avoid the conversation and claim they had no knowledge or understanding of the issue. No matter where you seized one of these apostles, your hand grasped slimy ooze, which spurted through your fingers only to unite again the next moment. So, I don't know if you can, you know, follow, remember one after the other, but this one is simplified, and the words are simpler, and the sentences are shorter. And then I don't like that Ford says your hand grasped slimy ooze when Murphy has Hitler saying your hand grasped only jelly and slime, which slipped through your fingers. Jelly and slime sounds a lot better than slimy ooze. Now, I don't know. This makes a big difference to me. Because when I read this Ford stuff, it is not the way Hitler spoke. It's not like it was ever even written in German. It's like it's something, that's been, rewritten in order to, make it simpler, but it's no longer, what Hitler thought. Now here's to go on then, which should I read first? I should read this one first. Murphy first. Now, he goes on, if your adversary felt forced to give again into a solid mass a moment afterwards, if your adversary felt forced to give in to your argument on account of the observers present, and if you then thought that at last you had gained ground, a surprise was in store for you on the following day. The Jew would be utterly oblivious to what had happened the day before, and he would start once again by repeating his former absurdities as if nothing had happened. Should you become indignant and remind him of yesterday's defeat, he pretended astonishment and could not remember anything, except that on the previous day he had proved that his statements were correct. That is, you know, he was being dishonest. Sometimes I was dumbfounded. That was the Murphy translation. And so Ford changes that into, do we get rid of the slimy ooze? Let's see. Oh, here. If your argument really gave a man a shattering defeat in front of others, he could do nothing but agree. You might suppose that this was one step forward, but how surprised you would be the following day. The next morning you will find that Jew has not even the slightest memory of yesterday and continues to repeat his own mischievous nonsense as if nothing at all had happened. When pressed about the previous conversation, he would pretend astonishment and could remember nothing at all except the truth of his statements, which he felt had been proved the day before. Frequently, I was simply paralyzed. Now, again, I don't know how it sounds to you. You might feel, certainly I'm sure there are people who feel differently than I do. But this does not give the sense of the way Adolf Hitler and his fellow Germans spoke. And also, to use the word paralyzed, I just don't understand the choices here, because Murphy uses the word dumbfounded. You know, when they came back the next day and acted like they had no memory of how I had proven my case the day before and they had lost, I was dumbfounded. Sometimes I was dumbfounded. And Ford says frequently I was simply paralyzed. Why would you choose a word like that? Being dumbfounded is not paralyzed. Being dumbfounded means you're at a loss for words, really. You don't quite know what to make of it. You know, you're just so surprised. You'd never met people like this before, but it's not being paralyzed. So, now I don't have too much time, so I got to get on with this. Who is this Michael Ford? You know, I was amazed to find out that he's somebody on Amazon. They say when they write about him, they say he began his eBay career in 1998 and first became an eBay power seller in 2001. Well, you know, he's what you call an entrepreneur. He's an entrepreneur looking for ways to make money. He had a software business. He expanded it. But he still enjoys buying and selling on eBay. He's authored a number of books on antique arcade games, game restoration, and computer security. He's a regular contributor to collector magazines and a business writer. It says here he's always been an entrepreneur, and eBay has helped develop those independent business drives into several full-fledged commercial ventures. Well, you know, nothing about him being any kind of a scholar or a German speaker or a translator or anything. He's not anything close to that. So the way I take this, and his book was published in 2009 by Elite Minds Incorporated. So it hasn't been around very long. And Elite Minds Incorporated is owned by him. You know, that's his company. So he published his own book. he has no credentials for what he's doing. But there are a lot of people who like it. Now, you have to ask yourself, you know, if they like it for the right reasons. I mean, he seems to be a clever guy. And I wonder if his name is really Michael Ford. But anyway, he seems to be a very clever guy, but I think he saw that Adolf Hitler was a big seller and that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the translations. You hear all the time that there's no good translation of Mein Kampf and people can't read it. They think it's because it's a bad translation. I don't think so. And then it's also very popular to say that Adolf Hitler was a terrible writer, terrible with language. That's absolutely not true. And because he didn't have a good education, he didn't complete his education, but he certainly was educated. And he had read so much that, you know, you learn a lot about writing from reading good stuff. And so there was nothing at all wrong with his German. But these people don't know anything, and so they say that. But also they say that therefore, these translations aren't any good. So it's almost like they're saying, well, Hitler was a poor writer, and so we need to rewrite this thing so that people will read it, you know, because people don't want to read it. It's too difficult to read. They start it, and they put it away. So let's rewrite it in a way that's simpler. Well, I guess an argument can be made for that. But again, I have to go back to if this is being done, that it needs to be labeled as such, clearly labeled, but he doesn't do that. So let me tell you what he does do. I think I have to go back down to his, I've got all these reviews by, Bitwork, who runs that Calvin EDU site, and he's translated tons of National Socialist literature. He has never translated Mein Kampf, but he doesn't think much of this Ford, and he has said some bad things. He called it when it came out in 2009, the first one, he called it a dubious translation and said he was suspicious of it for some of the reasons I've already told you, and then said that that there's a lot of errors in it. And, you know, he publishes on demand with his Elite Publishing Company. So people write to him and complain about the mistakes in his Mein Kampf translation, he corrects them. He corrects a lot of things so that the next time he prints one for somebody who buys it, you know, it's a corrected version. So he can do that anyway, and he's done a lot of it. So he just according to Bitwork, who really, I think he's, even though he's anti-National Socialist, he sees it all as propaganda that's not healthy, but I think he's honest and reliable in all his translations, and he doesn't mistranslate on purpose in order to make him look bad. He is a real scholar, he's associated with the university, and I really love that Calvin site, and a lot of people do, because he's made all this stuff available to us, and we, you know, we take it as what it is. We take it for being correct. So that's, there's that. Then he wrote and read another review for, well, this bit where he keeps coming out with new versions, see. And he, this one he said, Bitwork said has many gross misspellings, punctuation errors, and grammar errors. The result is poor. He says, somewhere I gotta get this that, that he hired, he didn't even do this himself. Where is that? He hired a couple of translators to translate Mein Kampf, and he wrote it in what he thought was a better, more understandable manner. So he's not even the translator, and his translations are not good in a lot of cases. Although it reads in a way, because see, he's good at this kind of thing. He's not, you know, it's not about being correct or scholarly. It's about making it so that people like it. And so he's done that. He's been pretty successful at doing that with it. But, now, the final review that Bitwork wrote in 2010 with for a second edition of Ford's book, Ford's translation, he says, that the second edition is as bad as the first. He says it's supposed to have been improved, but he thought not, it was not improved much. He says, it has the same errors and overstated claims. It's more gaudy looking, than the other. And he says he's fixed the number of errors, but, the blunders that Bitwork marked in the earlier edition are usually still there. And, he says, let me just give two examples. The first is indicative of the general sloppiness of the translation. Well, he says that the very first lines of the original edition reads, today I'm pleased that fate chose the city of Braunau am Inn of northern Austria as my birthplace. But he spells Braunau am Inn incorrectly and doesn't capitalize things correctly, and then he had written in his new version when he corrected it, he corrected some spelling, but then he added, he says, today I'm pleased that fate chose the city of Braunau on the inn, which is it could be an English rendition of northern Austria as my birthplace, and there was no need to say northern Austria because he says he says it's like if in English you would say I was born in Chicago of Illinois, you know, or I was born in London of England. You don't say I was born in Braunau am Inn of northern Austria, because it shows, you know, all these kind of things show his ignorance. And all it does, what bugs me is passing on ignorance, you know, passing it on. There's so much of that in today's so-called truth movement, where people come along and they just start to learn something and they pass things on in a way that is not, you know, it's not really altogether correct. They might have some idea there, but it's not all right. And then it goes on and around, and we are not the educated type of people we should be. This is just part of the dumbing down, you know, the dumbing down by accepting things that that are not right, but oh, who cares? That's good enough. Why argue about it? You know, why bother about little things? You know, that's kind of the attitude. Now, the second thing he says here is that a second error. You know, that's kind of funny. Was that he said the Frankfurter newspaper, a German newspaper in Frankfurter. Well, you know, there's a city, a famous big city in Germany called Frankfurt. And he's, and you know, as Germans, Germans will say, well, add an ER when they're describing something from a city, like the Berliner Zeitung, you know, newspaper that's in Berlin, or the Frankfurter, what is the Frankfurter Gazette or something that's in Frankfurt. But he even makes the mistake of calling the city Frankfurter because the paper is called the Frankfurt or something. So stupid things like this, which are not going to get in the way of your getting the essence, I suppose, of Hitler's thinking. But I'm also concerned about whether people are going to get the essence of Hitler's thinking when it's simplified so much that it can be, you know, misunderstood. So to go on with this a little some more about this Michael Ford, and also I think, you know, he's an operator. He's trying to make money. He has no connection to National Socialism. He has no connection to, you know, history or scholarly history or whatever. He's only done this because he thought that he could, you know, put out a book and that he could make it popular. And he has succeeded in doing that, which is really too bad, because he's also called it, I missed out on that somewhere, but he's also, you know, said that it was the choice of scholars. His book, in 3 months after it came out, he was advertising it as the choice of scholars. And Bitwork says, of course, it wasn't, and there's no way that in 3 months that something can gain that kind of prestige, and he doesn't know a single scholar that's using it and so on. So this guy is, you know, a general blowhard. Now, this mistake in this error in the Murphy translation is this, that in Murphy, let me get this. Well, I don't know that I've got it open here. 218. Okay, I'll read it in Murphy. Murphy writes, this is about Germanization. And what makes people German and not that, you know, if you can't just move to a country or state, which is what we have going on now everywhere, and become that, you know, the Turks move into Germany and then they become Germans. If you're a German citizen, you're a German. And he is writing here, talking about that, that some people are saying, you know, thinking that Austrian Germans can Germanize the Austrian Slavs and make them Germans. But he doesn't even go for that, see? And he says those people did not understand that a policy of Germanization can be carried out only as regards human beings. Well, this is the mistake, because he didn't say that. He said that a policy of Germanization can be carried out only regarding the land, the soil, but not the human beings. You can't take human beings and Germanize them. So this is an error. Although if you read all the rest of the paragraph, it all is the way, you know, Hitler meant it. So it's just this one sentence that gives the wrong idea, and it is wrong. But you know, people, translators do make mistakes. Now, Murphy, I can never think of his name. Murphy is not around anymore to fix it, and this book is not going to be come out again, I don't think, and it's not going to be republished because of that. So people just need to make that notice in their copy of what it should be. And I've got some variations here on what it should be. This George Held wrote to Bill Fink on his Mein Kampf site. And he's the one that told Bill about this. He said there was a bad mistake in Murphy's translation on the bottom of page 218, top of page 219, in the way it is in my book, and also Bill, what Bill has on his site is the exact page by page of the Murphy translation. So it corresponds exactly. And he says the book is wrong. He says the correct translation would be that those people did not understand that a policy of Germanization can be carried out only on the land or ground or soil and never on men or human beings. And I sent that to Hasso Kastrup, who does lots of translating. And I didn't tell him anything about it. I just sent him the original German, you know, from the original German. And he translated it. Those who promoted it, speaking about the people, did not understand the policy of Germanization. He said, those who promoted it were quite unaware of the fact that one can only Germanize land, but never people. And then this Reinald Hitchcock was quoted by George Held, and his is real long. Held says that Reinald Hitchcock is probably the most accurate translation. I've never heard of this translation, but it's very accurate, but it's very hard to read because it is very long and involved. And he writes, he translates it, even in pan-German circles, one could at that time hear the opinion that Austrian Germanity, with promoting help on the part of the government, with that is with help, you don't need to say promoting, but promoted by, with help on the part of the government, could very well succeed in a Germanization of the Austrian Slavs, whereby, however, one did not in the least see clearly that the fact that a Germanization can only be carried out with the soil and never with man. Well, I have to agree that that is too hard to understand. That sounds very overly complicated. And I don't think that the German would sound that way. But when you translate German into, well, I hit my 60-second mark already. When you translate German into English, it can get very convoluted, and he may have been going just real literally. And that's why you don't want to do that. But I think that the translations that we have are pretty good. Plus, considering this, you know, the copyright that the Bavarian government has on Mein Kampf is going to be coming to an end, running out in a year or two, and they're planning on coming out with different people are planning on coming out with annotated versions, which I don't like because they're going to be filling in with notes explaining, you know, Hitler in the way they want people to see him. So that's going to be a problem. But there can be well, we'll see what happens. But I have to say that I really don't recommend the Ford translation for all the reasons I said. But if you understand that it's a very simplified and might lead you in the wrong direction at times, then you can read it, because if it's the only one that you can bring yourself to read. Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. Stick with me. I'll be with you back. I'll be back with you again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.